Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Top coaches with multi-million dollar salaries, giant TV contracts, stadiums that can seat 90,000. Today's college football is more than just a game. It's big business. Some college presidents and athletic directors are riding the momentum, pushing for even more muscle and media on the field. Others are saying enough is enough. This hour on Point, we're looking at what's happened to college football. You can join the conversation. Are you drawn to the fanfare, the spectacle, the game day glory? Is college football good for college, for the players, the institutions, the mission? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear later in this hour from the president of one university, Northeastern, that just announced it will fold its football program, and from former All-American Michael Oriard, who's just out with a big history of college football. But here's some very recent history. Saturday, Florida beat Florida State 37-10. Here's a snippet of coverage from CBS, which aired the game.
Florida's 4 out of 6 on third down conversions. They look at a 3rd and 5 here. That's Tebow. He's got Hernandez for the first down at the 26-yard line.
How good is this guy?
How good is this guy? How big is this sport in money and all the rest in college these days? Florida, of course, advances undefeated to the SEC championship game against Alabama next week. Joining me now from Gainesville, Florida, is Andy Staples. He covers college football for Sports Illustrated. He was a walk-on offensive lineman himself for the University of Florida. As a freshman in 1996, this weekend he covered the Alabama-Auburn game and the Florida State-Florida matchup. Andy Staples, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What kind of season is shaping up here, first of all? Is this a high-tension season, or how do you describe it, Andy?
Well, it's a fascinating season because right now we're sitting here with 6 undefeated teams and a system that only allows 2 of them to play for the national title. So it's going to be very interesting to see how things shake out this weekend. At least one of those teams is guaranteed to lose this weekend and could be as many as 3. And it's going to be pretty fascinating because there's a debate that's been raging for a long time about how big-time college football, the NCAA Division 1A or football bowl subdivision, how it determines its national champion, because it's different than any other NCAA sport. There's this system called the Bowl Championship Series, which is basically, for lack of a better term, a cartel created by the 6 most powerful conferences to make sure they get to keep most of the money. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this shakes out, because there's government pressure on the BCS from Orrin Hatch at Utah and Joe Barton in Texas. There's talk that maybe the Justice Department's going to look at them for potential antitrust.
Absolutely. And because this isn't a playoff that leads these teams to the final championship, it's their assessment by a whole network of people. A lot of people say, let them play for the top spots.
Yeah, I'd say the vast majority of fans would like to see them play it out, either as a maybe a +1 system, which would basically be a 4-team playoff, or an 8-team playoff, or a 16-team playoff. 16 teams is what the other divisions in the NCAA use to determine their national champion. And yeah, it would be very interesting. And there are going to be some legitimate complaints at Texas Christian and at Cincinnati if they're undefeated and they're out of the national championship picture.
One big fan talking a year ago now, but this was candidate, or was it? No, maybe I guess the newly elected President Obama talking with Steve Kroft on CBS 60 Minutes. I'm not sure if this was before or after the election, but here he was, the now president himself, making a push for a national college football playoff.
If you've got a bunch of teams who play throughout the season and many of them have 1 loss or 2 losses, there's no clear, decisive winner, we should be creating a playoff system. eight teams. That would be three rounds to determine a national champion. It would add 3 extra weeks to the season. You could trim back on the regular season. I don't know any serious fan of college football who has disagreed with me on this.
Serious college football fan Barack Obama, elect Obama just after his election last year. So there's that controversy over how the bowl players and the bowl champs are decided ultimately. Take a look at the top teams for us this year, Andy. You've got Florida up there and Texas and Alabama, Texas Christian right behind, and more. What's strong? What's weak this year? What's pushing the best teams to the top of their leagues?
Well, Florida and Alabama will play this week in the Southeastern Conference Championship game. That's probably the most anticipated game in the history of the Southeastern Conference, which has been around since the 30s. They're both undefeated. Both of them have unbelievable defenses, maybe the best defenses either school's ever had. And they just they played a great game last year that Florida won, where Florida came in 11-1, Alabama came in 12-0. Florida won that game and ended up winning the national title. It's going to be fantastic. It's just going to be hard-hitting. It's not going to be a high-scoring affair, probably. It's just going to be a lot of really good, fast football players getting after it. And I think that's the game that everybody's really excited about watching. Texas, on the other hand, they came into the season and everybody thought it was going to be Texas and Oklahoma atop a very strong Big 12 conference. It turned out that Oklahoma was down. The Big 12 as a whole was down. Texas did exactly what they were supposed to do. They have a very good defense. They have a very explosive offense. Their quarterback is named Colt McCoy, which is one of the great quarterback names of all time. and he has a great receiver named Jordan Shipley that he throws to an awful lot.
Yep.
They connect for a lot of touchdown passes. So, those guys are very good. They've got to play Nebraska this week in the Big 12 championship game. And Nebraska probably has the second best defense in the Big 12 behind Texas. It'll be the best defense Texas has seen. And it'll be really interesting to see what they do against it, because I don't think Nebraska can beat Texas, because I don't know if Nebraska can score on Texas. But it'll be a good litmus test if Texas ends up winning and playing Florida or Alabama for the national championship to see how they play against an elite-type defense.
And Andy, what about the Notre Dame story? I mean, fabled football powerhouse facing a very long drought now. Talk that their coach, Charlie Weiss, may get the boot. They lost to Stanford, 45-38 over the weekend. Might go off, you tell us, but I mean, I've heard a rumor he could go off with $18 million if he goes. Their quarterback, Notre Dame quarterback, punched in the nose at a local restaurant in Indiana, fan dissatisfaction just that high. What's going on with Notre Dame, Andy?
Well, it's the same thing that's been going on for the last three coaching regimes. They expect to compete for national titles, and that hasn't happened. And there's a lot of factors behind that. Notre Dame is a very good academic institution. Notre Dame doesn't have a basket weaving major like a lot of these schools do.
Mm-hmm.
They've got high initial entrance requirements. Now, they're not as high for football players, but they're higher than a lot of the state schools have for football players. So they're recruiting from a smaller pool than these other elite teams. That doesn't mean they can't get good players. And Charlie Weiss, the current coach, soon to be ex-coach, recruited some very, very good players. Unfortunately, most of those players played on offense. And so they had a great offense this year and just an atrocious defense. And it doesn't work that way. And Weiss came in from the NFL. He was the offensive coordinator of the New England Patriots. And he came in with kind of an arrogant attitude. He right off the bat said that his team would always have a decided schematic advantage, quote unquote.
Yep.
And
what does that mean, a schematic advantage?
Well, that his schemes are better than everyone else.
I see, okay.
And as we've seen, they weren't better than Navy's, Connecticut, Stanford's this year. They weren't better than USC's any year that he coached them. So, that's not good enough at Notre Dame. And it's funny because Charlie Weiss basically got hung by his own words. When he got there, they were coming off a 6-5 season.
Yeah.
And he said, folks, 6-5 isn't good enough. Well, before they played Stanford, when they were sitting at 6-5, somebody brought that quote back up to him and said, Coach, you're 6-5. Is that good enough? And at that point, Charlie Weiss said, look, if they made a change, I don't think I'd argue with them.
Andy Staples, stand by if you would. I have with us Michael Oriard. He played for Notre Dame, was offensive captain, second-team All-American at Notre Dame in the 1960s. He is now professor of American literature and culture and associate dean of the College of Liberal Arts at Oregon State University. He's out with a new book called Bowled Over, Big Time College Football from the 60s to the BCS Era. Michael Oriard, thank you very much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for having me on the program.
It's great to have you with us. We just got a minute before the break, but how are you feeling about your Notre Dame there? All kinds of tumult.
Yeah, and Andy's just absolutely right. Notre Dame is not content to be good. They want to compete for national championships, and they do have that challenge of getting enough good athletes who can also make it academically. And Notre Dame's not willing to be a good program, say, like Stanford. They want to be a top program like Florida and Alabama, and it's a real challenge for them.
But is that an indicator of, we'll talk about this, but of what's happened to college football, that maybe you can't have a top-notch academic team and team on the field as it's constructed right now?
Yeah, I think it's becoming more and more difficult, not just for Notre Dame, but for, you know, the really best public universities like Michigan, say, UCLA, Cal, you know, they get really good students too. And so fielding a top program at really good universities is increasingly a challenge.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about big money, big time college football, and whether it's good for, whether it has anything to do with American higher education. Michael Oriard is with us. He's at Oregon State University now. Was offensive captain at University of Notre Dame, All-American there in the 1960s. Out with a new book, Bowled Over, Big Time College Football from the 60s to the BCS Era. Andy Staples is with us from Gainesville, Florida, staff writer for Sports Illustrated, covers college football. There was a walk-on offensive lineman himself for the University of Florida, no less, back in the 1990s. Back in January of this year, here's a bit when Florida won the national championship, the BCS title, beating Oklahoma 24-14. Here's the touchdown from that championship game. David Nelson, fourth quarter, sealed the victory for Florida, and Coach Urban Meyer here.
Lofted into the end zone. Touchdown, Nelson. Urban Meyer will celebrate the third national championship for the University of Florida.
Michael, Andy, let me go straight to some callers here. Robert in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Robert.
Yes, hi. Oh. Full disclosure, I'm a medical provider. But I'm 55 now, and when I was 14, 15, on the cover of Time magazine, on a big beefy arm, was imprinted USDA, United States Department of Agriculture. Ever since then, it seems like every 5 years, I hear about reforming the money in football, college football, et cetera, and they keep finding ways to make big money. And I have a side comment. Mm. No one less than Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Rider, in 1905, called for banning the game. 25 players died that year, and Colonel Mosby, the most famous raider in the Civil War, no stranger to death and mayhem, known as the Great Ghost, in 1909 he at least was able to get the forward pass.
But Teddy Roosevelt, all the way back in 1905, saying enough is enough. Let us look at that one. And thank you, Robert. Michael Oriard, your history really kicks in the 1960s. But take us back to those very early days. Where did football come from? How did it get into American universities in the first place? And what about that reception that our caller describes?
Well, actually, the challenges to college football started before 1905. Basically, American colleges began playing football in the 1870s, and we learned it from the British, and they had two versions, you know, what we call rugby and soccer, and we took on the rugby game and so on. And by the 1880s, you know, the game was beginning to evolve into the game that we know it now. The forward pass was not legalized till 1906, and it didn't really become used much for another 10, 15 years. But strangely enough, okay, you got to remember that back in the late 19th century, only about 2-3% of Americans are even going to college. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, why would anybody care about this game? And the answer, I think, is that the mass media of the day, which were these newspapers in New York owned by Joseph Pulitzer and later William Randolph Hearst, began developing the modern sports section and really pumping up the game. And most Americans learned about football through the media rather than the games themselves. But it just astonishes me to think how by the 1890s, this was a very big deal around the country, despite the fact it's just a few people who go to college.
And you write that college presidents all the way back then, more than a century ago, caught on very quickly, cottoned on to what this could do for their institutions.
Yeah, exactly. Sometime in the 1890s, you know, at the Thanksgiving Day game between Yale and Princeton with 35, 40,000 people there, or at some moment like that, university presidents had little light bulbs go off and go, whoa, we can publicize our universities and grow our universities through big-time college football. So really, the 20th century was a time when college football was not just kind of tacked on to American higher education. It was absolutely integral to its development. And the big programs that we have today happen to be, you know, at the major state universities and the major private universities, with some conspicuous exceptions, of course. And the relationship between those two is not just coincidental. I mean, football really did provide a growth mechanism for higher education. The question remains is, you know, how necessary is it today? But there's no question that in the 20th century it was important.
Andy Staples, what about today? I mean, when you're out there and people are fighting for championships, I'm sure the win is pretty much all they're thinking about. But you cannot ignore, in your line of work, I mean, you're constantly surrounded by the scale of this, the scale of the stadiums that you'll be sitting in, the scale of the television contracts, the coaches' salaries. And now I've even been reading about colleges endowing their quarterbacks and linebackers the same way they do with a distinguished chair in American history or literature. This is pretty wild.
Yeah, well, it's funny that the college that endows their athletic department the best is actually the best academic school in Division I-A, is Stanford. They kind of set the benchmark for doing that. So, it is. I turned into a business writer a long time ago.
As covering college football.
Absolutely. This is a huge business. I mean, when you look at the Southeastern Conference this year started a set of two 15-year TV contracts that over the next 15 years will pay them $3 billion.
Whoa. Just the Southeastern Conference.
Right. Whoa. Exactly. I mean, that's how huge it is. We do market research. ESPN does market research. The general consensus among media outlets is that right now college football is the second most popular sport in the country behind the NFL.
That's a lot of money. Michael, is it working for colleges or is it just working for football? Can it end up being a net drain on the academic side of the shop?
Well, if we're talking about the Football Bowl subdivision, most of the schools in that division do make money on football. Most of them don't make enough money to have a profit on athletics overall. Only a couple dozen at most actually make a profit overall. So towards the bottom of the Football Bowl subdivision and outside it in the Football Championship subdivision, money is being lost, and it's a real challenge. Later in your program, you're going to have the president of Northeastern who's down there and has faced that challenge. At the top, you have a relative small number of programs, like a couple dozen, that really are making lots of money and making big profits, actually, for the university. But they're rare.
We'll look at that and how that came to be. In fact, we have the president of Northeastern University with us right now. Joining us from Boston is Joseph Aoun. He's president of Northeastern. Earlier this month, Northeastern decided to fold its football program. President Aoun, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
How did you make this decision? You must have some really, you must have big football fans there. Every college does. It can't be an easy decision, but maybe it was. How'd you make it?
Well, it's never an easy decision, and we have always been guided by the principle that we should focus on our opportunities for leadership. And frankly, in this environment, to raise the level of our program to a national level and a competitive level would have required additional multimillion-dollar investments on an ongoing basis. So a consensus emerged behind discontinuing football and focusing future resources on programs both academic and in athletic, where the university can achieve leadership. It's as simple as that, but it's always a difficult decision.
So was it strictly a dollars and cents decision then? It was going to be too costly? Was that the bottom line?
We are guided by achieving excellence in the areas we offer, whether they are athletics or academic programs. And in this environment, when we believe that we have to focus on our areas of strength mm-hmm. in athletics and in academic programs, and when we are rebuilding our economy, higher education is critically important to rebuilding our knowledge-based economy. And universities have an obligation to invest resources in areas of strength, whether they are competitive athletic programs or cutting-edge academics. So we cannot afford to not to have excellence in all areas we offer.
President Aoun, what have you heard from your alums who were, are football fans?
Well, we actually, some of our fans have been not happy with our decisions, and some of our fans, have actually been vocal in voicing their support, too. So we have heard it all.
Has anybody said, that's the last check you'll ever see from me, Prez?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We have some that said that and some that applauded the decisions, but the decision we made. But at the same time, as I said, we continue to consider that athletics is an important part of student life, and we will continue to participate in 18 different intercollegiate sports and more than 40 club sports and hundreds of intramural teams.
And let me ask you about other college presidents perhaps around the country. Have you had calls from them saying, you know, Joe, how did you think this through? How did you reach this conclusion? I wish I could do it or something else.
Well, as a matter of fact, yes. I received emails and messages from my colleagues, and I can share with you that my colleagues have been very supportive and have been asking questions about the process and how we reached this this decision. And yes, some are saying off the record that this is not only a very good decision given the parameters of excellence that we set up to achieve, but also that they are interested in pursuing a similar strategy in their own institutions.
Michael Oriard is with us from Oregon State. He's just written a big book on the history of football. And Michael, you hear President Joseph Aoun of Northeastern here. He's done something that is very rare, and he's just done it straight up. What are you thinking as you hear him describe this, Michael? What would be your question for him?
Well, you know, I think you've asked those questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the challenge facing presidents in those situations are that they're losing a lot of money on football, and so then the question is, well, what are we getting in return for that investment, and is it worth it? And you know, the research that's out there is unfortunately too incomplete to really know for sure. But in general, the research says that expenditures and that athletics do not generate contributions to the academic missions of the universities, and athletics do not increase the recruitment of top students. The problem is there are few places where these things have happened, and everybody thinks they're going to be among those few successful ones, the so-called Flutie factor,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you
Doug
have
Flutie,
a suddenly
Boston College, yep.
Yeah, you know, and so, for example, Gonzaga University in basketball, when they became the mid-major darlings of the NCAA basketball tournament, they really had an tremendous spike of applications to the university. So these things can happen. It's just that they're extraordinarily rare. So presidents like President Aoun have to look at what they've got, what it would cost to be competitive, as he says, within his own conference, and you know, make a determination whether or not that's a good use of institutional resources. You know, at public universities, state legislatures are disinvesting in higher education. So the pressure is really beginning to squeeze them more and more, and they're going to be in the same position that President Aoun has been in.
Joseph Aoun, what was your bottom line figure? If you were going to go for leadership, as you say, if you were going to go for a nationally ranked team, how many millions did you reckon that might have taken?
I think it's going to, you know, the total sum would have exceeded an initial investment of around over $30 million for a stadium, plus an ongoing investment of at least an additional $4 million, $3 to $4 million that would bring on a yearly basis, which means that overall we would have had to add around $9 million on an ongoing basis to football, mm-hmm. including maintaining and the stadium, including the salaries for the coaches, etc.
Are you sleeping well with your decision, Mr. President?
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Are you sleeping well with your decision?
So far, so good. But I think that it's the community is getting together. And as I mentioned, some fans are really supportive, and others are still absorbing the impact of the decision.
President Joseph Aoun of Northeastern University, they have announced they will fold their football program. President Aoun, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Andy Staples, that is serious money that Joseph Aoun is describing. Do you hear other colleges thinking twice about it out on the football trail, Andy, or is it all just go-go?
Well, they feel like they have to go-go because a lot of, I'm talking about at the top end,
mm-hmm.
because they're in this now. And as Professor Oria was saying, in the football bowl subdivision, the football programs do tend to be profitable. Now, they don't necessarily tend to make enough profit to support the entire athletic department, but they do tend to be profitable. So they do go, and in a lot of cases, you know, there's so many alums and so much money coming in from those folks that they can't handle the I'll never write you another check again scenario that
mm-hmm.
that was going on at Northwestern. Because at Northeastern, that was probably a handful of people. Let's say the University of Colorado did that. That'd be a lot of people saying, I'll never write you a check again. And I don't know if they can take that. And Colorado's an interesting example because their head coach, Dan Hawkins, probably would have been fired this year in any other economy. But because the economy's down, because donations are down, they couldn't afford his buyout. They couldn't afford to buy him out, which would have cost them $3 million, and then to pay another coach, which would have been an initial investment of, you know, $2.5-3 million for the first year. So it's
incredible.
That's one of the interesting side notes of the down economy is that a lot of coaches who would have been fired are getting to keep their jobs this year.
In for a dime, in for a dollar, in for many dollars, Michael Oriard. This is a tough business to get out of.
You know, absolutely. And the fear of the repercussions has to be just enormous. You know, even at a place like Northeastern, I don't know mm-hmm. what kind of attendance they had. And, you know, out here on the West Coast, I'm pretty certain that not too many football fans, college football fans, care about Northeastern's fate and all of that sort of business. But say they get only 5,000 or 10,000 fans at a game, you know, what else do they do at the university that brings in 5,000 or 10,000? And those 5,000 or 10,000 are potential donors and so on. So cutting loose from them is really difficult. As Andy says, it'd be enormously more difficult at a place like Colorado. And without knowing the Colorado situation specifically, I'd be pretty sure that they are really struggling to, you know, to break even in their athletics, and you know, legislative funding is down, and
mm-hmm.
and they're going through the same kind of agonizings that Northeastern has gone through, but they have much more at stake.
And maybe can't afford to buy out their highly paid coach, and I'm sure they wouldn't be alone in that. Michael Oriard, author of Bowled Over, please stand by. Andy Staples with Sports Illustrated. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about big money, big time college football and whether it's good for, whether it has anything to do with American higher education. Michael Oriard is with us from Corvallis, Oregon. He's a professor at Oregon State University, played for Notre Dame back in the day, an All-American there, author of Bowled Over, Big Time College Football from the 60s to the BCS era, just coming out. Andy Staples is with us from Gainesville, Florida, staff writer for Sports Illustrated. He's been at big games just over this weekend and sees it inside out. Andy, Michael, here's a couple of emails. One from BG says, I'm a faculty member at the University of Virginia. Our coach was fired yesterday but the school must still pay him what is left on his contract, $4.3 million, and yet we're suffering state budgets cut, new hires have been frozen, we're told not to expect a raise for years. The administration claims the football program makes money, but many on the faculty doubt this. That's out of the University of Virginia. And here's another from Virginia Tech. This is from Danielle saying, as a Virginia Tech alum who was on campus during the shooting in 07, I'd like to bring attention to the unifying force that the presence of such devoted football fans exerts. It really pulled the campus there together, she writes, during the time of that tragedy. She says, of course, we're proud of our academic programs, but the visceral togetherness that fanhood gives you was crucial to stabilizing that community after the tragedy. There's two different, very, very different perspectives out of Virginia, Andy, on the cost of football, but also the kind of glue that it can provide.
Well, and to the Virginia faculty members' point, the Virginia Athletic Department made it pretty clear. Now, I'm not positive they're telling the truth, but they made it clear that no state funds will be used for that $4.3 million to buy out Al Groh. Now, the question is, no state funds are being used for that $4.3 million, but will they be used to help supplement any sort of deficit in the athletic department budget in the future? So, I mean, that could be an accounting trick. But I'm looking it up right now. The most recent submission by Virginia into the Equity and Athletics report at the Department of Education said that the football program in 2008-09 made $20.2 million.
That sounds like a lot of money. Michael Oread, when you hear that, do you nod and say, yes, sure, I believe that, or are you skeptical? You hear the faculty members' skepticism.
Well, you know, the two faculty members, the one from Virginia and the one from, or the alumnus from Virginia Tech, I mean, they sum up the dilemma. I mean, because both of them are absolutely right. You know, football is this unifying force. You know, the students get excited about it, the alumni get excited about it, and so on. But whether or not the university can afford to provide that kind of excitement and that kind of bonding is a different matter altogether. And, you know, the two needs collide with each other, and there's no simple resolution. You know, your question, is it possible to dial this down? I mean, that's a real, real hard one. I mean, all of the bonded indebtedness for new facilities that institutions face, you know, apart from the other costs that we've been talking about are enormous. You know, we've ratcheted it up, and ratcheting it back is not nearly as easy.
Let's take a call from Wayne in Hadley, Massachusetts. Wayne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Picking this up, I applaud the two college presidents in Boston who have jettisoned football. Silber did it years ago at BU, and I'm a former professor of music at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
Uh-huh.
And over the years, I've come to believe that the accounting, as Mr. Staples just said, may be a lot of smoke and mirrors. And the money that they say is coming in, it may be coming in, truly, but where's it going?
Dollars are fungible, that's for sure. What about the academic side, Wayne?
It bothers me that the stories my students told me over 30-something years were that at least the star athletes that they were supposed to be in class with weren't in their classes, that they showed up every now and then, maybe to take a test, but there's a whole network of something out there that gets them grades. And the word on the street among students is that they're not really there for athletics, for academics, and they managed to get by various ways. There's an ethical question there that I think we rarely address. The money is so powerful. And my thought when I hear that Virginia's football program is $120 million, great. Why don't we have a college football league that doesn't use athletic facilities of the university and let them get back to letting every student have some kind of athletic experience instead of just going sitting on their bums at a football stadium, which is the most costly piece of real estate in the whole university complex. It's used for 8 games.
Wayne, you're terrific, and I appreciate your call. Michael Oriar, there's a lot on the table there, but part of it goes to the ethical issue of pushing athletes through, at least as far as they go, without a real education. And then Wayne's out of the box, maybe radical answer. You know, make it a farm league. Call it college if you want, but don't pretend.
You know, it's interesting how, you know, Wayne is right on target with claims that have been made or challenges that have been offered, you know, for literally decades. But yeah, we've been talking about the issue for the institution, but what about the issue for the student athletes? You know, universities are getting increasingly selective, and we're not just talking about Notre Dame and Stanford and Vanderbilt and Georgia Tech and a few of those, but we're talking about the major state universities like, you know, Alabama, you know, like Florida, like mm-hmm. Texas, like Ohio State. And, you know, the SAT score of incoming freshmen are going up. And, you know, I think it was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution last winter published an investigative report that demonstrated that the average football player's SAT score is 220 points behind the average student at the institution. And so that disadvantage coming in almost is going to guarantee that those student athletes aren't going to feel they really belong in the classroom as students, and you're going to have those situations that Wayne was describing where, you know, they're not fully engaged. And so the question for the student athletes is, are they getting the benefit from their participation in this big time sport, you know, that they deserve? If millions are being made for the institution and millions are being made for the coach, what about the athletes? Now, the idea of a kind of semi-professional league would acknowledge them as athletes and, you know, compensate them somehow comparably. Or if you want to go to the other direction, you know, at least make sure, guarantee that you can provide a real education for them, which, you know, is an incredibly difficult thing to do if they're, you know, not as competitive academically as the rest of the student body. So, you know, these are all really, really hard choices that institutions would have to face.
Andy, you know these guys. You played college ball. So did Michael Oriard. When you talk with college football players today, do they feel abused, you know, exploited, or like they've been given a golden ticket maybe to the NFL and the earnings that may be there if their health holds up?
It depends on the player, and you know, I got to say, I agree completely that a lot of these guys have no business being in college, and they're here, they're there because they can play football. I've heard the other side of that argument. I remember sitting in Doug Dickey's office when he was the athletic director of Tennessee, and he said, "Well, how many of these kids would go to college if not for this?" You know, a lot of these guys are the first in their family to go to college. A lot of them aren't going to the NFL. They're still going to get they're going to get a degree. Maybe their kids will go to college now. You know, so I've heard the other side of the argument. It's hard to justify though when you meet some of these guys and you talk to them, you think, oh, how in the world is this kid handling college coursework? But on the flip side of that, the stars in college football and men's college basketball get absolutely abused. You know, I live in Gainesville. I walk around here. Every store you go into has a number 15 jersey for sale. That's Tim Tebow's jersey. Mm-hmm. He's a quarterback at Florida. Tim doesn't see a penny from those jersey sales, but they're buying them because it's him. They're not buying them because it's a Florida jersey. They're buying it because it's Tim Tebow's jersey. And, you know, I find that interesting, especially when Tim, who is, you know, he's the son of a missionary. His dad runs an orphanage in the Philippines. Tim had to go through hoops with the NCAA just so he could organize a flag football tournament to raise money for his dad's orphanage. So, you know, these guys don't really get, they get their scholarship, but if you're a star football player or a star men's basketball player at a major college, you are bringing in so much money and so much positive exposure for your institution. And I just don't think the reward of the room and board and tuition really covers that.
But of course, historically, the idea of a college athlete of any kind making money off playing it, whatever sport it was kind of anathema. Michael Oriard, you write about the turning point from your day playing for Notre Dame in the 60s, the sort of the roots of what we've got today. Remind us of what the major measures were that put us on this path to the super big mega money.
Okay, you know, first I'd like to mention one thing. Sure. Like Andy, I was a walk-on offensive lineman at Notre Dame, so I bonded with
Been
him
there.
Over there.
I feel for you.
But yeah, okay, in 1972, freshman football players and basketball players were made eligible for varsity competition. It had been done a few years before for the so-called minor sports. And then in 1973, the four-year scholarship was replaced by the one-year renewable scholarship, and then there are a couple other changes at the same time.
So perform or be gone, essentially.
Exactly. Now a kid is accountable first and foremost to his football coach, not to his professors in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I'm thinking that the consequences of this were not foreseen, but not surprisingly, also at the same time, entrance requirements for athletes were reduced. So by the late 70s, early 80s, you began to have this just massive amount of academic scandal at various institutions, really embarrassed the universities in a terrible kind of way. And the NCAA began struggling in the early 80s and continues to struggle to try to make that right. Then, you know, the other really key event, you know, in big-time college mm-hmm. football was in 1984 when the Supreme Court ruled that the NCAA's control of selling football rights to television violated antitrust law and had to get out of that business. And so that turned institutions and particularly conferences loose. Again, you know, the consequences weren't felt immediately, but by the 90s and the creation of the Bowl Championship Series and the
they
arrangements.
They could cut their own deals. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the point at which this enormous disparity between the really wealthy programs and the ones at the bottom kept getting wider and wider and wider. And also, it, you know, created this situation in which these athletes who, you know, as Andy says, are still getting tuition, board, and room like they did back in the 60s, mm-hmm. but their coaches now, instead of making $20,000, $25,000, are now making $3 and $4 million. Mm-hmm. You know, college football is an enormously lucrative popular entertainment for everybody except for the athletes. Yeah. Like Andy says, like Tim Tebow, you know, yeah, he doesn't sure. make a dime off this.
Off those T-shirts, rack upon rack of them. Tom in New York City. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
You're touching on an issue. I've had an opportunity to work with several major college programs, one of which was UCLA, in the wake of some off-field kinds of issues that impact their players. And one of the things I think you're beginning to touch on is the impact on the student-athletes themselves. And there is a point of view, especially around issues that affect them, whether they be arrests or violation of other on-campus rules, that there is a perception, albeit not a, you know, a somewhat limited one, mm-hmm. that there, since many of these, you know, young people are being recruited out of inner cities, they're minorities, they're African-Americans, you know, there's a perception that, you know, a lot of big-time college football could be perceived as a modern-day form of slavery. Much money is being made. Very little is being pointed out goes back to the athletes themselves. And we would hear stories of what it would be like to be a student-athlete on a major college campus, you know, who happens to be married with a child, and the NCAA, you know, affords them X number of dollars a month to live on.
But what about the path to the NFL that we often see opened up here? Is that not a kind of compensation, Tom, or not?
Well, what is the percentage? I mean, what is it? Less than 1% go on to play professionally. What is the phenomenon that goes on with the other 99%+ of college football athletes? What are their lives like afterwards?
That is a great question, and several other callers, Lauren and others, are raising it, I see here. Michael Oriard, how about it? What do you know what percentage go on to play pro ball, and what about those who are just used to help fund those big stadiums and then, you know, maybe never even get the degree? They're just out.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to a really, really, really important point. It's maybe more than 1%, but the last figures I can remember reading were 54,000 played college football and about 1,000 each year signed some kind of contract with the NFL, and about a third of those actually make it, you know. And of course, you know, the numbers from the Floridas and the Alabamas and the Texases are greater than, the numbers from Northeastern. But still, you know, the great majority do not go on to the NFL. You know, we should point out, by the way, of course, that big-time college football is part of a whole larger football culture in which, you know, the millions out there in the NFL that are available to those good enough and fortunate enough to get them, you know, are enormously tantalizing. So, you know, my guess is every kid goes to a big-time football program with the expectation and hope of playing in the NFL, but for most they don't.
Does this ever change, Michael? We've just got a minute remaining here. I wish we had more, but with these enormous money pressures, does this I mean, Northeastern's changed, some individual colleges, but can you see a real change in the structure of what we do with college football in this country?
You know, I think there's going to be a change, but it's not going to be decided by the NCAA or even the college presidents, you know, kind of sitting down and let's do it the right way. Something's going to come from outside, you know, some lawsuit on behalf of the Tim Tebows who aren't being compensated for the use of their images is going to be successful. Or, you know, the networks or the BCS is going to decide that, you know, we got to do things differently. And all of a sudden, some programs are going to be cut out. It's going to become too expensive because you have to compensate athletes more. Something's going to happen because I think the situation we're in can't be sustained, but I don't know where it'll come from. It'll come from outside, though, I think.
Andy Staples, you're covering college football for Sports Illustrated. Look out a couple of years. Do you see a job threat there, or is this an institution that's going to roll on and keep you covering those games?
Oh, I think it'll be around, but it like Professor Oryard said, it may be around in a slightly different form as we go forward.
Well, it sounds like that would not be a bad thing, but huge forces and huge guys at play here. Really great to have the two of you with us in the middle of the run-up to bowl season for a look at college football today, and I'm very grateful to you both. Michael Oryard with the new book, Bowled Over, Big Time College Football from the 60s to the BCS Era, joining us today from Corvallis, Oregon, professor at Oregon State. Professor Oryard, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for having me. It was fun.
And Andy Staples with Sports Illustrated, walk-on offensive lineman at Florida in 1996. Thanks for joining us today, Andy.
And thank you, and hope I bump into Professor Oryard at the Civil War in Eugene on Thursday.
There you go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us.